Now today we find ourselves on the road with Jesus and the gang. They have been traveling through the Galilee for some time. And in chapter 9 of Luke's gospel, where we start today, up until verse 51 where we started, the disciples have already seen Jesus feed 5,000 people with 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. Peter has rightly proclaimed Jesus as Messiah. A few of the disciples have witnessed the transfiguration. All of them have seen Jesus heal a young boy with a demon. And they've all heard Jesus tell them that the least of them will be the greatest. And this is important. They've also heard Jesus tell them that when they are traveling for the kingdom, when they are following Jesus, if they are not welcome in a place, they are to kick the dust off of their feet and continue on to the next place. And all of that then leads us up to verse 51, where we set the stage for today's passage. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. Now, that word resolutely means something. It is not an accident that it's there. It means determined, or it means with resolve, or with no sign of turning back. Some translations say that Jesus set his face toward Jerusalem, and some of them say that he was determined as he began his journey to Jerusalem. And so the first test occurs in Samaria, a place where there was plenty of animosity on both sides. The Jews didn't like the Samaritans, and the feeling was mutual. And if it helps you to get a little perspective on this, the West Bank, you know, you've heard of the West Bank. Almost every time we hear about the West Bank, there's some kind of bomb or some terrible thing happening. The West Bank in 2016 is the place where Samaria used to be. That's what they called it back then. So that helps us get an idea of the depth of mistrust between the two groups. And so they come to Samaria. And Jesus has been teaching them all these great lessons and giving them all these good instructions on how to be as disciples. And so he sends a couple of scouts ahead to kind of get everything ready. And when they get there, the Samaritans do not welcome them. And so when Jesus gets there, James and John look at Jesus and say, "Do you want us to bring fire down from heaven and burn them up?" I don't know about y'all, but I remember something about when you go someplace and you're not welcome, you should shake the dust off your feet and go to the next place. Do y'all remember that? Well, the disciples did not remember that. And so Jesus rebukes them, and he does what? He shakes the dust off of his feet, and he gets ready to go to the next place. Now, just so you know, the admonition to shake the dust off your feet and go to the next place has nothing to do with passive behavior. It's about keeping your eye on the goal, which is always Jesus, raining fire down from heaven against the Samaritans. Puts the focus either on the Samaritan behavior or on the indignation of the disciples. But the focus is not on Jesus. But I digress. Remember, they're on their way to Jerusalem, and Jesus has set his face resolutely, so nothing is going to stop them in this journey. Now, just to give you an idea of this journey to Jerusalem, it takes 10 chapters in the Gospel of Luke for them to get there. 10 chapters. This is no little weekend excursion. Well, after the debacle in Samaria, the travelers then meet 3 separate people, all of whom say they want to follow Jesus. And so Jeff did such a good job of reminding us who they are. The first one, who says he will follow Jesus, finds out that to be a disciple renders someone to be homeless. Or in other words, he says, you mean you don't make hotel reservations before we get there? The second one finds out that family is not as important as Jesus. In other words, attending a funeral is more about the people who are alive than about the deceased. The third person finds out that hard work is always in front of us, not behind us. In other words, if we spend all of our time looking at what we've done, we can't ever go forward and do the things we need to do in the future. Obviously, these three were not very good at spur of the moment kind of living, which is exactly how Jesus asks us to be, to respond immediately. How many of you have ever heard of Ariel Sharon? Anybody ever heard of Ariel Sharon? He was one of the prime ministers in Israel, and before he was a prime minister, he was a general, and he led many, many soldiers into battle. And he was known for being very hard-headed and for racing into the battle when other people wanted to be more cautious. He is credited with saying, "Attack, and the logistics will follow because they must." He knew that once they were in the heat of the battle, that the logistics would fall into place because everyone would be supporting the very focus of what was going on. Now, how many of you would say that you're a follower of Jesus? I would say I am. So maybe the church today needs to say, step out in faith in ministry, and ministry will happen because it must. Instead of lining up our ducks and getting them all in a row before we even take that first step. Christ will take care of the logistics if we follow him into places of difficulty. Make arrangements for ministry, devise your own plan, put off the urgency of that which is before you, and you just might miss an appointment with God. When we say, "Yes, Lord, but a little later," we're letting our fear and our worry dictate the parameters of the journey instead of letting God work in our lives. Sometimes we won't even take the first step because we can't see a successful outcome before we even start. Sometimes we volunteer for ministry and we find out it's a little messy. And so then we avoid all future trials into ministry. We say, "Oh, I remember the last time. I'm not doing that again." Sometimes we put family before God, and it can become such a habit that pretty soon we just use family to hide from God. It seems to me that the church has lost its ability to say, "Go for it." It seems that we spend a little too much time thinking and a little less time doing. And even worse, we have become a people, some of us, who condemn folks who step out in faith and who fail at the task because things got a little messy. We judge success and failure by the smoothness of the logistics rather than by whether or not lives have been touched by the hand of the Holy. I have heard far more criticism from Christians than I have from those who are not even acquainted with the church. I bet anything that at UM Army, y'all can tell me, people who didn't even go to church ever looked at you and said, "Thank you for coming to this place today." They didn't say you weren't dressed right. They didn't say, "Why are y'all all chewing gum?" They didn't say, "Clean up that mess." They said, "Thank you for coming today." Am I right? No criticism, just thank you for coming. Learning to be comfortable with unknowing and with a little messiness is what our faith is all about. We get so wrapped up in our own success that we begin to measure our faithfulness by how little wake we leave behind us. I was raised on the Gulf Coast, so if you don't know what I'm talking about, when you're in a boat and the boat goes through the water, there's some water in the back that kind of gets disrupted. And the slower and more cautiously you move, the less amount of disruption you will see in the water. It's when you go fast that the water gets all stirred up. And yet sometimes in our modern day church, we believe that our greatest successes are the ones that disrupt the water the least. Now, one day several years ago, this was before the drought at Lake Buchanan when there was water the first time. We have water now, but for a while there wasn't any. And so several years ago, I went to Lake Buchanan one day or a couple of days to kind of get a little bit of quiet time and just to be by myself. And so I was standing in a comfortable house there with the air conditioner on, and I looked outside, and there's this little beach that I could see, and there was a woman sitting on a bench all by herself on this beach. And I kind of looked through the window, and she sort of looked sad to me. I couldn't really see everything, but I could see that from time to time she was wiping an eye. So I thought maybe she was out there crying. And I thought, I don't want to bother her. That's such a private moment. And so I decided, well, I'm going to go outside anyway and sit out here and enjoy this breeze. And so I sat out under the trees, and the breeze was blowing. It was just really so lovely. And I found myself kind of opening one eye and going, oh, she's still there. But she looked so sad to me. I just didn't feel like I could interrupt her. And so finally, I looked, and she just let her whole body just fall, and she buried her head in her hands. And there was no mistaking it. I couldn't think that maybe there was just something in her eye at that point. And so I kind of had this sensation, go talk to her. And then I heard my mother's voice say, don't talk to strangers. I had to let that go. Mom, not right now. This isn't the time. And I had to argue with myself, because it just felt so awkward to go up to a total stranger who was obviously in great pain and say, hi, good to meet you. So I didn't know what to do, but I just kept hearing this voice say, go. And so I went over, I walked through the yard, I walked, I went over, I sat down. She didn't even see me coming. And I finally sat down on the bench next to her, and I put my arm around her, and I said, I'm a United Methodist pastor, and is there anything I can do? And she looked up, and her eyes got really big. And then she just started those heaving sobs. Women, you know what I'm talking about, that real nasty kind of crying we do sometimes? It's just like everywhere. And she couldn't stop crying, and so I finally just hugged her. I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any words, and I didn't know what to do, so I just hugged her, and she just cried and sobbed and cried and sobbed for, it seemed like a really long time. It probably wasn't all that long. But when she finally stopped sobbing, she sat up and she started telling me her story. Her teenage daughter had died a few months previous, and she just couldn't get through the days anymore. And she would go to work every day and find herself crying in the middle of work. And so finally her friends at work said, you ought to go to your lake house and go up there and have a little time by yourself and see if that'll help. And so she told me all of that, and I listened, and you know, I didn't have any like magic words for that. And so I just looked at her, I said, can I pray with you? She said, yes. So we prayed, and after the prayer, she said, I work at Southwestern University in Georgetown. Now, if you know anything about Southwestern University, you know that it's affiliated with the United Methodist Church. And she said, I'm a Methodist, but I haven't been going to church much. I work with Methodists, but I don't really go to church, but all the people at work said I should go. And so here I am, and I believe God sent you here today for this very moment, just to sit here with me. And so I want to thank you for sitting down and praying with me, taking the time. And I'm thinking, oh my gosh, I'm the one getting the blessing here. And so I tell you that story not so that I can say, look what a great thing I did, because I really didn't do anything. I tell you this story to say that if I hadn't listened to that voice that said, get over your awkwardness, quit worrying about your natural inclination of not wanting to talk to people you don't really know, and just go, if I hadn't listened, I would have missed an appointment with God. God gives us opportunities for appointments every single day. We have no idea how many of those appointments we miss because we can't catch up on the journey. God gives us the opportunity and we take it or we don't. Well, both of us were blessed that day, and when she left, she managed to give me a smile, and she promised that she would go back to Southwestern and tell her coworkers the role that they had in that day as well. God sends lots of people to help us when we need help. Now, we know what's expected of us as followers of Jesus, but somehow we have a hard time committing to service unless we're calling the shots. God will equip us on the journey as we go along, but not before we get started. Do you understand that? God equips us as we go, not before we start. God speaks to us, and all that's expected is for us to respond to the call. If we sit around waiting until the conditions are right, we might find that we've spent a lifetime sitting on the sidelines. But if we walk into that battle with God as our guide, He will take care of the logistics for us. If we learn to lean on God for our understanding more than we lean on ourselves, that's in Proverbs, you can look that up, about the fifth chapter or so. God will get us through it. That's a promise. When we follow Jesus, we can't cling to relationships or possessions. We can't cling to our natural inclination with one hand and reach out to get Jesus' hand. You see that this clinging keeps us here. Jesus calls us to come with our hands empty, ready to walk with Him. When we follow Jesus, He asks us for total commitment. Now, He isn't saying ignore your family. He isn't saying go live in the desert without any shelter or food. He isn't saying to forget the things of the past. But He is saying that following Him comes with a cost. He is saying that we have to put Him in front of family. We have to sleep in discomfort and eat some crummy food when we follow Him. We have to look forward way more than we look backward. Jesus isn't out to punish those who don't commit 100%. If He was, we'd all be punished, every last one of us here today. But He is looking for people who can put Him first, and who can give up some of their comfort and some of those natural inclinations that's code for staying in our comfort zone. He's looking for people who will come when they are called. When we insist on perfection, insist on making sure that we do everything right instead of everything in faith, we do ourselves a disservice, we do God a disservice, and we do a disservice to those who are counting on us. Richard Rohr, I don't know if you know him, but make it a point to read him. He says this: we grow spiritually much more by doing it wrong than by doing it right. Perfectionism discourages honest self-knowledge and basic humility, which are foundational to spiritual and psychological growth. Those are hard words for us to hear, because we are a culture that seems to value being right more than we value good intentions. Jesus is looking for all of us to come when we're called and not to worry about being criticized for our efforts. I promise you, there will always be people who are going to criticize. And more often than not, those are the very ones who are sitting on the sidelines. Working for the kingdom is active, it is risky, and it is messy. We can't let a little thing like criticism hold us back. We can't let a little thing like discomfort hold us back. We can't let a little thing like not being in control, Lord have mercy, hold us back. Jesus needs every single one of us, every one of you sitting in this room, all of us. Jesus needs every single one of us, because there's so much work to do. And so may we have vision for ministry. May we be comfortable in saying, go for it, instead of pointing out all the ways that ministry can go wrong. May we all answer the call when it is given. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit. Amen.